This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, community control of police. How practical a goal is it? And demonstrators in Haiti demand fair and honest elections and an end to the United Nations occupation. But first, hundreds gathered at New York's historic Riverside Church for a dialogue between Bob Avakian, an avowed atheist leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Dr. Cornel West, the Black public intellectual and revolutionary Christian. Bob Avakian began the conversation.
What gives meaning to life? What is truly a life with a purpose? Living in this country, in this cutthroat system that plunders the whole world, you are encouraged and constantly pulled to be absorbed in self. The selfie is a perfect icon of this culture. All too often, what we hear from people sounds like a singer warming up. Me, 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 me. We need something radically different. If you're in a different situation, a desperate situation, you are driven to hustle, scramble, and scuffle to get what you can, while things work to keep you from understanding why things are the way they are and what can be done about it. But as I've said before, if you've had a chance to see the world as it really is, there are profoundly different roads you can take with your life. You can just get into the dog-eat-dog and mostly get swallowed up by that while trying to get ahead in it. You can put your snout into the trough and try to scarf up as much as you can while scrambling desperately to get more than others. Or you can try to do something that would change the whole direction of society and change the way the whole world is. When you put these things alongside each other, which one has any real meaning? Which gives any real purpose to life? But let me say this. I'm a confirmed atheist, a stone-to-the-bone revolutionary communist. Yet Cornell is much closer to my heart than many atheists. Why? Because too many atheists use their atheism to sit smugly, satisfied with the world as it is, or even use it to justify the world as it is. Cornell is a voracious intellectual with a deep appreciation for the life of the mind, but who also understands that a role and responsibility of an intellectual is to stand with the wretched of the earth and take a stand in the fight against oppression. And I would much rather walk with Cornell than with a smug atheist. Now, don't get me wrong, there are some very good atheists, communists, humanists, and others, but all too many who are justifying going along with the way things are. So in ending, let me say this. The movement I envision and am working for is one where people like Cornell and myself can walk together on the road of revolution and emancipation, uniting in the struggle to bring about a world where there will no longer be the wretched of the earth, but human beings giving ever greater expression to their humanity in a myriad of diverse ways. And yes, we will argue, even at times vigorously, about how to bring this into being, even as we proceed arm in arm together.
Bob Avakian of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Dr. Cornel West works out of Union Theological Seminary, just across the street from Riverside Church. Dr. West framed the moral issue at hand this way.
What does decency do in the face of insult? Integrity, honesty, decency in the face of insult. Oh, that's a tough question. Never forget what Henry Highland Garnett said the first time black people ever came together in the public sphere outside of slavery in Philadelphia in 1837. He looked out and saw 300 black people. And he said, black folk never confuse the situation of black people with those of the Israelites in Hebrew scripture. For us, Pharaoh was on both sides of the bloody Red Sea. And you could imagine, just like Shelley's poets, somebody in the back said, can somebody sing a song, please? That's where Nina Simone comes from. That's where Mahalia Jackson comes from. That's where Aretha comes from. That's where Luther comes from. That's where Donny Hathaway comes from. That's where Carmen McRae comes from. That's where Mary Lou Williams comes from. That's where Jerry Allen comes from. Our dear sister, Professor Farrah Jasmine Griffin, sitting right there in the second row, talks about this with such insight and perspicacity. The song, the musicality is a form of combat because you seem to be in a situation as if you can't find a way out. One of the reasons I like to work with so many of my revolutionary communists is not because I'm so thoroughly overcome with their communism, but they hold out a grounded utopian hope that there's a way out of this system of terror and trauma and horror and stigma. We got to provide some way out. And sometimes the only way out is to sing a song. It's true. I was just in Birdland the other night talking to the jazz musicians. They said, oh, Brother West, if you knew how jazz provided us a way out when John Coltrane brought us together and told the group, we will never, ever talk about money. It's all about the music. Because the music is a way of empowering the souls. And empowering the souls provides folk the capacity to straighten their backs up and tell the truth and expose the lies and to bear witness. Be willing to die. Yes, but when you do go, allow your sacrifice and your witness to somehow prefigure what you're fighting for. That's what we're talking about. That's where the alliance between religion and revolutionaries of a secular kind play a fundamental role, even as we agree to have disagreements, even when they're deep ones. Last question. What does virtue do in the face of brute force? You cannot talk about revolution. You certainly can't talk about black people, or brown people, or red people, or working people, or poor people here, or anywhere around the world. It could be my Dalit brothers and sisters in India, so-called untouchables. It could be the precious brothers and sisters in Africa who are often overlooked, undervalued in our analysis. But the issue of brute force, it's fundamental. Unlike Brother Martin Luther King Jr., though he and I are both Christians, I'm not a pacifist. Oh, no. No. Not at all. There's a radical sister who was a Sunday school teacher in Chicago, one of the greatest freedom fighters of the early part of the 20th century. Her name is Ida B. Wells. She wrote a book called Red Terror in 1890s. And what did she say? She said there ought to be a Winchester rifle in every black home in the name of self-defense. She said that in the name of Jesus. Just like my deacons for self-defense coming out of John Coltrane's state of North Carolina. But it's got to be one in which what sits at the center is this profound commitment to radical love. And by radical love, what I mean is a steadfast commitment to the well-being, beginning with the weak and vulnerable, beginning with the least of these, beginning with those Frantz Fanon called the wretched of the earth. And when you have a deep radical love for those Sly Stone called everyday people, or those James Cleveland call ordinary people. Then you have a burning hatred of the fact that they're being treated unjustly. You have an intense loathing of the fact that they're being treated unfairly. And if you don't do something, the rocks are going to cry out, which means you have got to be organized and mobilized with the most sophisticated analysis of the systems against which we fight, but also a memory of those who came before. So the moment you feel dismayed and disappointment, just know, disappointed, just know when the folk were struggling against slavery 200 years ago, they were in a worse situation. When they were struggling against Jim and Jane Crow, it looked as if it would never, ever be overcome. So we tell our young folk, we understand the soul murder that you have to go through every day in these disgraceful school systems where they don't have instruments because they don't want you to learn how to play the music of Thelonious Monk and so many others. We understand the massive levels of unemployment. We understand the indecent housing. We do understand the degree to which it's difficult to gain access to quality health care, even given the progressive liberal market-based health care of Brother Barack Obama, who put forward it alongside his Wall Street presidency, his drone presidency, his massive surveillance presidency. Thank God for Edward Snowden. Thank God for Chelsea Manning. Thank God for the whistleblowers who tell the truth. Thank God for those who want for transparency. Yes, indeed. But this is the kind of alliance we want. This is what we're struggling for. This is a unique historical moment. Why? Because historically, black rage has always been the central threat to the status quo. Historically. Not because black people have a monopoly on truth, goodness, or beauty, but because when black folk wake up, lo and behold, all people who are subordinated and dominated can get in and wake up. This is what we understand together. This is why we're here. Thank you very much.
Dr. Cornell West at Riverside Church in New York City. Across the Hudson River in northern New Jersey, the People's Organization for Progress, POP, has been battling police brutality for more than three decades. Larry Hamm is chairman of POP and has long wrestled with the question of how to exercise real community control over the police.
One of the major structural reforms that we have been fighting for has been the establishment of a police review board at Newark. Now, this call for a police review board far exceeds even the existence of the People's Organization for Progress. This demand for a police review board arose in Newark around 1966 after New York City created its police review board. And people saw that as a progressive reform. And so, you know, Newark and community activists in Newark and in other cities began to call for the establishment of police review board in their towns and cities. But I'm going to say this. I support the establishment of a police review board, but I'm not overly optimistic in terms of the impact that it will have in terms of ending police brutality. Now, one could make an argument and say, well, if we're talking about New York City has had a police review board for over 40 years. And the incidents continue, and then people say, well, that's because the police review board really doesn't have the powers it should have. It should have subpoena powers. It should have investigatory powers. It should have the power to impose fines and punishment on the police. And if we have that kind of police review board, then you'll see a difference. Well, I've yet to see that kind of police review board come into existence. And it's going to be very interesting in the city of Newark to see how the struggle for a police review board plays out. Because the new mayor of Newark, New Jersey, Ross Baraka, the son of Amiri Baraka during the 60s and 70s, all his life, called for the establishment of a police review board in Newark. His son supported the establishment of the police review board when he was elected councilman and when he was elected mayor. And now steps are being taken to form that police review board. But I predict that it's going to be a bumpy road because, one, municipalities, the power to subpoena is a power that devolves from the state. Now, I'm not talking about the state in general, in a Marxist sense, I'm talking about like the state of New Jersey. Municipalities are creations of state legislatures, and they are guided by, regulated by the laws that are created by the state of New Jersey. So to empower a police review board with subpoena powers to establish that kind of police review board in Newark, there would have to be enabling legislation in the New Jersey state legislature. And I'm sure that we could find a black state legislator who would be willing to draft the bill and introduce the bill. But the question then becomes, will a bill to empower a police review board in Newark with subpoena powers and other powers, will that get through the New Jersey state legislature? And I would dare say, if I was a betting man at this point, that it would not get through a state legislature.
Given the power of the Fraternal Order of Police.
Exactly, exactly. And people must understand the police are not only a paramilitary force, they are a political force. And the police organizations lobby. They lobby state legislators. They lobby congressmen for laws that strengthen the police, for laws that benefit the police, and for laws that essentially keep the police beyond the control of the citizens. So it's going to be very interesting to see if this progressive mayor, the son of an activist, a mayor who himself was an activist, who himself led, I remember Ross Baraka when he had an organization that was called Black Neo-Force. And in the aftermath of the shooting of a young black woman, Strawberry Daniels, on Clinton and Seymour Avenues in Newark, New Jersey, Ross Baraka and Black Neo-Force led a march of hundreds of residents of the South Ward of Newark out of the South Ward all the way down into downtown Newark. That movement was so powerful that it led the then mayor of Newark, Sharp James, to actually begin a serious discussion, convene a meeting of community leaders, elected officials, religious leaders, and community activists, including yours truly, to have a serious discussion about how a police review board would be created. But the effort petered out. It had a strong beginning, but it eventually petered out. You know, was of course the way to keep something from happening is refer it to a committee for further discussion. And it never happened under the James administration. I think a serious attempt will be made under a Baraka administration to establish it. But then the question will be, will it end up being a police review board that can really drive the behavior of the police? Let me say something else about another group that seems to escape scrutiny when we have these discussions about police brutality. And that group are elected officials. In my humble estimation, the police will only go as far as lawmakers let them go. And that goes for black lawmakers and white lawmakers. And if you're not getting a strong signal from elected officials that this will not be tolerated, that you will be punished for this through the passage of laws that will outlaw police brutality or so on and so forth, or that you will be fired, you know, if you're identified as an officer that has a record of brutality, that you will be fired, that drives behavior. And you don't see that. Elected officials have really, in this whole discussion, they have really escaped a lot of the fire on this issue.
Yes, in those localities where there are lots of black representatives, if that's also accompanied by lots of police depredations against the community, then those officials have helped create the environment for it.
That's right, because how many black elected officials do you actually read about taking a stand against police brutality? In every community, you have one or two, like Charles Barron in New York City, who will speak out. But the majority of them don't speak out. You don't see all the black elected officials getting together and having a joint collective press conference and saying that we are not going to tolerate this. We're going to pass either municipal ordinances or we're going to introduce state legislation to out. They don't do it. because they fear the PBA, they fear the Fraternal Order Police, they fear the police organization at election time. And they have really, you know, the police deserve the criticism they get, but I really feel that elected officials and even a lot of community leaders have really escaped criticism. You know, how many pastors of churches do you see taking a stand against police brutality, taking a public stand? I mean, you really have to have an outrageous act like the murder of Michael Brown or the strangulation death of Eric Garner to get some of them, even in those cases, only some of them will step out and say something.
Most often they seem to step out and say, be calm.
That's right. Or some of them will even take the side of the police. And that's another dimension of the complexity of the issue of police brutality. Another dimension is the crime in the black community. It's a serious issue. I mean, people can't get back and forth to work, particularly the people that got to walk from their house to catch the bus. People get killed, and they're not even the intended target of the shooters, but they get killed by stray bullets. Women get robbed, get their pocketbooks snatched. I mean, the crime is a real serious issue. And what the right wing does, and I'm talking about the right wing in the black community as well as the white community, there is a right wing in the black community. There is a conservative element. And I'm not necessarily talking about the pundits like Armstrong Williams. When I came back home from Princeton, I was a student at Princeton University. When I moved back home from Princeton in 1980, I left graduate school and returned home. How many years is that? That's 34 years ago. The first Star Ledger newspaper I picked up had an article where community leaders in the Vailsburg community, the West Ward of Newark, were calling on the mayor, Ken Gibson, at that time, was calling on the mayor of Newark to bring in the National Guard, not to put down the rebellion, but to supplement the police of Newark in the patrolling of the black community. So this crime becomes a wedge to open the door for further, they talk about militarization. This was 34 years ago when not the elected officials, when the community leaders were calling for the National Guard to come in, calling for the military to come in and patrol their streets because they felt they were unsafe.
And that was only 13 years after the New Jersey National Guard came into Newark and wound up killing a whole bunch of black folks.
Isn't that something? Isn't that something? And it's something to really consider. And it makes it hard for those of us who fight police brutality. I give you another little story. We march in the Black Heritage Parade every year, and they always place us in the rear, you know, because they don't like our strong political message, because we be carrying our signs, you know, we look at it as a way to get the message of struggle out to the community. So they placed us in the rear where they place all the community organizations. So they placed us behind a group called MomSAD. I think this was after 9/11. So this might have been 12 years ago, maybe 2002, 2003. We were marching behind this group called MomSAD. Now, MomSAD is an acronym for Mothers of Murdered Sons and Daughters. These are mothers who speak out against the crime in the black community and the homicides, the murders that take place against the black community. And all of these mothers, most of them, I don't think any had daughters, most of them, their sons were killed, you know, by other young black people and so forth. So we're marching behind MomSAD. So we're chanting, stop police brutality in the black community. The MomSAD people confronted us during the parade and wanted to know why we were attacking the police and not attacking these young boys who were going around killing black folk in the black community. Now, it is out of confrontation that change comes. To make a long story short, this started an ongoing, it started out on a bad foot, but it ended up being an ongoing dialogue that actually brought Pop and Mom Sad together. Because what we would do when the Mom Sad would have their candlelight vigils around the deaths of these young people that have been killed by the killers in our community, you know, we would go to their action and they would come to our actions. Because what we did, we introduced the mothers of those who were murdered by other Black people to the mothers of those young Black men who were murdered by, and sometimes women, murdered by the police. So we brought the mothers of the two groups together. And now Mom Sad has become, in fact, the head of Mom Sad is a member of People's Organization for Progress.
And sociologically speaking, those mothers were the same.
That's right. Those mothers were the same, but in their minds, initially, in their minds, and in the minds of many to this day, they are not the same. And there's an element in the community that supports the police. I'm talking about regular people. I'm not talking about elected officials, religious leaders, POC leaders, or any other leaders. I'm talking about people that live in the community, go to work every day. There's an element of them that support the police 100%. They ain't thinking about police brutality. They're thinking about having enough police so their car is not broken into, so their house is not broken into, so their children can go to school and come back unarmed or come back alive. So this makes the struggle complex. It makes it complex and it makes it difficult, but this is a reality that we have to contend with, and we have to learn how, and I say we, I include the People's Organization for Progress, we have to learn how to navigate these contradictions so that we can build a greater unity in the community to oppose the powers that be. Because the same forces that have caused this high crime rate in the Black community are the same forces that support the militarization of the police, support essentially the move towards fascism in the United States. And we're moving. We're already in a police state. And it didn't start with Ferguson. It started long before Ferguson. I would say it started in the 60s after the major uprisings during the mid-60s. That's when this whole effort to militarize and beef up the police began, in my estimation.
And so in terms of community control of police, you have been and would be supportive of efforts to create these structures, but never put down the power of direct pressure from the people.
In fact, the power of direct pressure from the people is the engine of change and is the engine of reform of policing in the United States. These reforms will be meaningless unless there's a real people's movement that is constantly on guard to make sure, one, that the reforms are implemented, and two, that the reforms are not taken away by those who oppose them. You know, the civil rights movement is instructive, right? History is not like a novel with a beginning and an end, with chapters, everything is wrapped up. you know, we won and we move on. You know, in one period, people fight for reform. In another period, another group of people fight to eliminate those reforms. The crowning achievements of the civil rights movement were the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. And we have seen in the last decades how the right wing has moved to undermine the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and is now on the verge of eliminating them. Because remember, they're acts that have to be renewed by Congress. And there are people who are openly talking now about not renewing the Civil Rights Act and not renewing the Voting Rights Act. And those states for which the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act were mainly created, those states and places for which these laws were created, to fight discrimination, we see those same states now reimposing in new forms and not so new forms means to keep Black people away from the polls. So even though you get a reform, even though you might win the legislative fight, to have the reform, you know, there are all kinds of steps in between that you have to take to make sure those reforms remain in place, are strengthened if they need to be strengthened, and you have to be able to ward off attempts to reverse those reforms. Let me just say this also, Glenn. We fight for community control of police. We're fighting for a police review board, but I'm not overly optimistic that the fundamental nature of the police are going to change unless there's some fundamental change in the society. I believe that this fight against the police is going to be an ongoing fight, because no matter what reforms we put in place, even if the police move away from, let's say, overt forms of brutality that are unjustified, they are still going to be in a role where their job is essentially to repress the black community. As poverty increases in America, crime is going to increase in America. As poverty increases, deprivation is going to increase. And people are going to become desperate in their attempts to survive. And in their desperation, they're going to invariably commit acts that are illegal. And if people go into a supermarket and they steal a loaf of bread because they're starving, should that person be killed? I mean, someone is going to call the police. Invariably, someone is going to call the police. And the police are going to come, and their job is to stop whoever is taking the bread. But if the people are starving and don't have bread, they're going to want to get that bread by any means necessary. So I don't see, even if the police, let's just say tomorrow, all the unjustified killings stop. And let's just say tomorrow, all the unjustified stop and frisk stop. That's still not going to change the fundamental role of the police as an instrument of social control and as an instrument of class control.
Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey. Activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray is a practitioner of movement politics in Columbia, South Carolina. He's also an editor of the new book, Killing Trayvons, an examination of racist violence in the United States. Gray says black people haven't maintained the institutions that can even measure the scope of police crimes against the community, much less prevent such abuses.
In the past, the NAACP in local areas was the place to report police abuse. And so some organization needs to take on that role again, because I don't see the NAACP doing it in the way that they've done it in the past, where it was, you know, you take the complaint, you go through a process where you contact elected officials, you make the community aware of how the police organizations are working. We don't have that steady stream of information or that functionary that takes those complaints to where now, if a person has a complaint against the police department, they got to take it to the police department. And then the police department investigates themselves, and 99% of the time they exonerate themselves.
The FBI and other law enforcement agencies are justifiably criticized for not keeping good data on abuse of black citizens, but the black community is not keeping data either. I think that's what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And I don't think that we can depend on them just to inform us as to how they're doing us and what they're doing to us. I mean, you know, we have to have some kind of mechanism that does that. And we've got to figure out a way to displace the idea that every time something happens, that people call somebody like Sharpton, whose job it is to come in there and figure out who are the troublemakers and report it back to the authorities.
So we've got a bunch of personalities running around for their own purposes, but we lack infrastructure in the community for its own, in a broad sense, self-defense.
Absolutely, and we lack a coherent, consistent, ideological framework these days. As I said, you've got older black people who, for reasons not borne out by statistics, want more police. They are afraid of young black people. Now, it's an anomaly when young black people terrorize or attack. You don't see incidents where black a youth have a wave of crime against elderly black people, but you got elder black folks supporting these ordinances that are fining people for wearing their pants down below their waist. You've got people supporting stopping kids for loud music in the same way that white man Dunn felt it that he was empowered to shoot Jordan Davis for loud music. You've got a lot of people in our community, older people, that support that kind of conservative, hardline, more police in the neighborhood concept that creates the friction between the police and young people and create the opportunity for police to stop and harass and often kill young people and even older people. So we've got to get our act together as to what it is that we expect out of the police, and we've got to move from this conservative law and order drift that's even in our community.
Well, you've got a little age on you, as do I. Is what you're recounting in terms of the attitudes of some older black Americans something of recent vintage?
No, I mean, there have always been these kinds of cleavages in the community. A lot of it's class, a lot of it's age. Some of it is wanting to be next to the white man, wanting to be accepted by the man. And on a lot of these local boards and community groups, the people that go to these meetings and sit there and talk to the police are older citizens. Young people are out working and doing what young people do. And you've got these older people that the power structure has put in place to pretty much protect this power and its abusive treatment of certain segments of our community.
Now, you were saying that where you are in South Carolina, black politicians are backing stand your ground laws.
Yeah, I mean, we got like Todd Rutherford, who's a young Democratic legislator who was, of course, an Obama supporter. I mean, there's these new young legislators who believe that they've got to act and sound like white folk. It's out of that Clinton, Neo, Blue Dog, DLC strand of Democrats. They believe in gun rights and being tough on crime. And I mean, the lawyer that you go to here in South Carolina for stand your ground defense is Todd Rutherford, the so-called progressive black Democratic legislator. And of course, in South Carolina and the South, folk are big on gun rights and big on the Second Amendment. Now, I believe in the Second Amendment and the right to self-defense as well. I believe the Second Amendment is there to protect the First Amendment. And the courts have consistently ruled that if anybody comes into your house, be it police or anybody unannounced, you have a right to self-defense. You might not make it through, but you got that right. But this idea of extending the Castle Doctrine to no duty to retreat, where if you don't have to kill somebody, you should walk away, and giving people this carte blanche, basically, to shoot people, that's a dangerous place to be. That's a dangerous place for the country to be in.
Well, that's certainly a different side of black politics than is reflected in the book that you edited, Killing Trayvons.
We tried to put what was going on in this country in context in Killing Trayvons, an anthology of American violence in which you're a contributor. And, you know, when we look at the Michael Brown case, when we look at Ayanna Jones or Karen Johnson or Aaron Grant or any of the cases, they all have the context of black life has no value in a white supremacist society. You know, none of the stuff that's happening now is new. I mean, be it police shootings, be it lynchings, people of color, their lives have always been cheap or have no value in a white supremacist society. And, you know, I think the book makes that case. I think the book serves to put a lot of what we're going through with the Michael Brown case and what's going on in Ferguson in context, so that people understand that Ferguson is America.
But you also seem to be saying that some of this conservative black thought that you've been talking about in your immediate environs in South Carolina is an internalization of that larger society's attitude that black life has no value.
Well, you know, look, part of it is that black people want to be accepted by white people. They believe that white people, as Malcolm said, is the standard of something, is the measure of equality. And that is certainly not the case. But over the recent years, from Reagan to now, we're still in the age of Reagan, the politics in the black community have shifted to a more conservative politics in which it doesn't fight for its interests. It supports charter schools. It supports this idea of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, which is nothing more than a Wall Street insurance funding mechanism. It's turned to supporting wars and being just as rah-rah as those people that chant USA at sporting events or wherever. Our politics are not the progressive politics that we thought we were supporting in the 60s and 70s and the 80s. There are people like us, and I'm hoping young people are now starting to pay attention, that can raise the contradictions and talk about the context of our struggle and talk about what can come next. What kind of country are we trying to help build? How do we make the country more progressive? How do we fight off this idea that the country is moving to the right when we know it has no option but to move to the left into a more socialist economic structure and a more socialist outlook on how we relate to one another?
Kevin Alexander Gray in Columbia, South Carolina. Thousands of Haitians demonstrated in the capital city of Port-au-Prince last week. We spoke with Azili Danto of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network.
The protest occurred on November 18th, which is the 211th anniversary of the Battle of Verchères, what we call at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership the greatest battle, the greatest struggle in world history, because that battle ended for the first time after almost 300 years of European chattel enslavement in Haiti, where there was slavery all around the West. It ended for the first time, slavery, colonialism, forced assimilation, and the slave trade. So it's critically important, but even more, we go further back. That was a pivotal battle that ended. Also, there was 1,500 years of Arab slavery that was going on. This was the first time in world history the Africans went back not to the culture of their conquerors, but to the cultures of Mother Africa. So Haiti's Vaudouist, Creole, and not taking on the name of any European or Arab country or Arab influence. It took the name of Haiti, which was given by the Taino people that were killed. So yesterday was that day, November 18th, when the protest came out. People in Haiti are under occupation since 2004, strict occupation. Obviously, you know, neocolonialism started in Haiti in 1806, and we've been battling since then to not undo Verchères, to not undo that battle, to not go back into slavery. But that protest, November 18th, people came out into the streets, thousands upon thousands, I mean, and they were asking for some specific things. They were asking for an end to the U.S. occupation behind U.N. guns and private military subcontractors. They were asking for the militarized sort of Ferguson-like police to stop killing the people. They were asking for mock elections to not continue in Haiti and real elections to go on. Your audience should know that since 2011, there's been a need for elections of the parliament, one-third of the parliament, and needs of election for local municipal elections. But Matéli, Michel Matéli, a former Compas singer who was elected under very fraudulent elections, is the puppet government for the United States, him and his prime minister, Laurent Lamothe. Yesterday's protest was also about getting Michel Matéli and Laurent Lamothe, the puppets to the occupation, to end their reign in Haiti. And specifically, the people were asking for real, true elections.
You say the people want real elections, not mock elections. What do you mean?
Since the occupation began in 2004, when the UN and foreigners with guns are the ones that are carrying the ballots, making sure certain ballots don't get to certain places to be counted, which happened in the 2006 elections during Préval. I still have ballots here where I am in the United States that people, you know, in Haiti gave me from back then, where the UN had brought them to be burnt because they were coming out of Cité Soleil. So when foreigners kind of own your space, they can do whatever they want with these elections. And, you know, there's no real electricity in Haiti, and they're going to elections, and it's all in the hands of the international community. Let's put it that way. They're the ones that are actually financing it. But more sort of like technically. Michel Martelly appointed the CEP, which is the Electoral Council, which gets to choose who is qualified to be a political party, to be a candidate. And there's been a gridlock between the parliament, specifically six senators in Haiti, that have refused to put through the law, the electoral law, because they say that it's already stacked up for the Martelly government and whoever they might want. And so it would be an exercise of futility, a mock election, to go to the election where the electoral council is made up of mostly people that the government has chosen. So the six senators in particular have been at war with the Martelly government with regards to the electoral council trying to get them to put in independent people. And so they have refused to have elections because they said it will be mock elections. I must point out that the United States, there was a group of U.S. Congress people who came out to tell the six senators that they need to do what Martelly wants. And the Haitian Lawyers Leadership actually responded to those six senators, and we have a letter out to the U.S. Congress telling them, here's the situation in Haiti. Martelly has been actually ruling by decree since he got there. The deputies, all the deputies are pretty much lapdogs to the Martelly government, and so they've been bought off. There's been accusations of corruption that the Prime Minister of Haiti has everyone in his pocket. So essentially, it's only those six senators that have been holding off, and those six senators were part of that protest on November 18th, saying to the government that real elections cannot happen with this electoral council, and there has to be some changes made. And this has been going on for 3 years now. But at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership, we always say that you can't even have any sort of real elections while you are under occupation.
And of course, ever since the U.S.-backed overthrow of Jean-Bertrand Aristide's government in 2004, his party, the most popular party in Haiti, has not been allowed to take part in elections.
Precisely. And that makes this particular crisis going on in Haiti particularly interesting since 2004. Because right now, in 2014, President Aristide is in Haiti. Before, some of the excuses for not allowing Fanny Lavalas to participate in any election is that the head of the political party of Fanny Lavalas, which is President Aristide, was not in the country to sign for the registration. That was their excuse. So now the Duvaliers and the oligarchs who are in power right now on behalf of the imperialists can never win an election in Haiti. They know that, so they have to rig it. It's extra hard right now because President Aristide is in Haiti. Their last tentative, actually, to destroy the movement for liberation is something that the United States always uses. It's not necessarily true that President Aristide represents all that is radical in Haiti. That is not true. But the United States uses that in order to destroy all radical movements in Haiti. And that narrative is being played out right now because it's easier for the imperialists to find one person who they've demonized, who represents one person, one vote, who represents Haiti popular wish for change. So they can create all sorts of narratives to fuel the fire that the crisis that's going on in Haiti right now is about Aristide and Martelly, and not the fact that Martelly and Lamothe have not been able to govern because they are not providing the people with any sort of a real relief. Since the earthquake, you have Lamothe and Martelly following the Clinton neoliberal privatization, tourist, and sweatshop ideas as progress for Black Haiti. This has not helped the Haitian people. So today, the crisis is the fact that the people are more hungrier, are without job, are without shelter, and those are the real issues of Haiti. Where the imperialist, all he cares about is using us as a market for his pharmaceutical goods, using us as a ground to train troops from all over. So he doesn't care about Haiti's real needs. So in essence, You have the situation where there's a big crisis happening. We have a puppet government. We are under occupation. And in that scenario, the people are trying to find a way out. And that's why the six senators who have been against the Mattarella government's manipulation of the system to give this sort of veneer of democracy happen when there is no democracy happen. The United States is right now in a very critical point with regards to Haiti because as of January 12, 2015, the parliament will be dissolved because there has not been any elections and all of the terms of the deputies will be finished and there will be no parliament specifically. So that's one of the reasons people were in the streets and the United States is trying to manipulate that. Right now he actually is ruling by decree, but the colonial narrative is that that's not going to happen until the parliament is dissolved. So that's sort of the grand situation at the moment.
And this would force the kind of mock elections rather than genuine, fully participatory elections that people oppose.
Precisely. So now we have all sorts of people on the streets, not just, let's say, the Haitian people who've been on the streets since day one, since 2004. We also have added to that fuel, let's say the deputies whose terms are going to be over on January 12th, and they see that their paychecks are no longer going to be around. So they're trying to see who has the greatest power, who can might bring them back into the gravy train. We have the senators coming into this. So you have all these various people. So we're trying to really say to folks, listen, the United Nations has to go before we can have anything that would resemble real sovereignty in Haiti. So rather than be talking about elections, we should put all of our forces, all of our focus on exposing the fact that the United Nations in Haiti is the AFRICOM of the Western Hemisphere. They're just using Haiti because we're the weakest country without any European father or larger dog or China or Russia or any of the five UN post-World War II powers that would support us. And since we don't have that, we're at the mercy. It's like the Napoleon army, which back in 1803 we beat. That army now, that colonial army right now, is made up of all the nations and they have come back. Racism comes before socialism, so whether it's Evo Morales or he's part of this group of ministers, whether it's Venezuela or Cuba, they're part of the NGOs, they're part of investing in the tourism, where the people have been disenfranchised and a U.S.-supported person has decreed that all Haiti's offshore islands are taken by eminent domain, and right now in places like Ilavache, the people are dying. They've put dogs on them. They've put sort of militarized police like the Ferguson, and these are people that before then, before these troops got onto this island off of Haiti, there was only two policemen, and all of a sudden there's over 300 policemen, and they're not there for the interests of the people. I want to name this man. He's sort of like the Mumia person of Haiti right now. He's in prison. He had a community radio where he was going against the taking of their land, and his name is Jean Lamy Martinez. And I indict Venezuela for all the time since February 2014. This young Haitian warrior has been in jail because Venezuela is the one that is putting in $27 million on tourism in Ilavache. And so these people who talk about being radical, they have turned a blind eye to the suffering of the Haitian people, and we're really trying to figure out who internationally, what we can do. At the Haitian Lawyers Leadership, of course, since the beginning, we've asked for a voiding of the status and SOFA agreement that was illegally signed by a UN employee in the name of Haitians, which brought in the minister of troops in Haiti. We are asking for when we do have our liberty back. Haiti's first thing to do is to get rid of the UN, get out of the UN. And so that's really what we're looking at the moment. That's the situation we're facing. We're looking for a way out. We're looking for allies, and we see none.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com.
where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.